The 1999 Salt Lake Sun Symposium presents Session 123, The Grammar of Grammar, with Dennis Clark and comments by Elizabeth Hall.
An altitude about 25 feet when they moved farther up the hill. Dennis is the division mangler at the Orem Public Library, the cataloging division. He works with cataloging, he does spreadsheet obsessively, and he cleans the office probably also obsessively. He has a BA in English from the Brigham Young University, an MA in poetry, an MA teachers in English, a master's of librarianship at the University of Washington. He has published a number of poems in some poetry books. He has co-edited with Eugene England, and I believe that is available for purchase today, Harvest, Contemporary Mormon Poetry. Is that right, Dennis? His associations and organizations, I think, are some of the most interesting aspects of Dennis. He belongs to Ganglia, a gathering of poets, Faction, a writer's group for fact and fiction, the Great Western Trail Association, the Lunch of Friday Club, which meets on Tuesday, the Guild of Utah Procrastinators, which has yet to meet, and the San Rafael Swells, a hiker's club. He has received numerous awards and recognitions, which consist of his recognizing himself every morning in the mirror, which is reward enough. He finds all information pertinent being a librarian, and he says that this is the only form which he finds impertinent, and he has not attached a copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica to the necessary bio information because he cannot successfully staple a CD-ROM. He came from one family. He founded another family with Valerie Godfrey, and he has spawned three others through two sons and a daughter. My observations about Dennis are that he is intimately concerned with substance rather than form, reality rather than appearance. He is one of the most witty people I know in all senses of the word. He's very funny, and he's also highly intelligent. He's interested in knowing knowledge in all its forms. He's a very avid hiker who loves the natural world. And I personally have been a great admirer of his rather jungle-like garden at his home across the street from the Orem Public Library. As a husband and father, what I have noted about him is that he is involved and sensitive to and with the lives and concerns of his wife and children. And I think that is one of the highest forms of praise that a man can receive, his sensitivity and involvement with those he loves. Dennis Clark.
Required all of this to transport one little paper up here. And if I have any luck at all, or you do, I'll use it all before we're done. But after that introduction, I have to warn you, you're in for disappointment. Can't live up to that advance billing. We were driving across southern Idaho and stopped for gas. Cody, whom we were driving to Seattle, found an ad in a local newspaper for a new movie. We were only 37 miles away from the theater in Idaho Falls and decided we could make a run for it. The movie was sold out, but there was another available in the same Cineplex, the just-released Schwarzenegger paranoid thriller Eraser. So we bought tickets and went in. Arnold displayed his muscle as a U.S. Marshal, saving a woman from people who were stealing a top-secret rifle that could see through walls. That's about the substance of the movie. Afterwards, as Cody and Colin and I drove on towards Mountain Home, I felt vaguely uncomfortable about how often the F-word had been emitted in that movie. There had been very little blasphemy, as if that were too passé to accompany the shocking images of murder. I wondered, in the words of Desmond Morris, why should sexual activities also be the source of dirty words and dirty gestures? There is nothing dirty about sex, so why is there such a widespread use of it in this way? It occurred to me that one could use the relative proportions of those kinds of emphatic speech, dirty words and blasphemy, as an index of how intimacy is under attack in our culture. So I talked with my boys about that. The three of us talked about it, a little uncomfortably, somewhat preachily, as we drove on to the next town where we crashed around midnight in a state park on a bluff above the Snake River. It seemed clear to me that there was some kind of a conspiracy in the entertainment industry to attack the true intimacy that sexual intimacy affords. As I drifted off to sleep, it occurred to me that worship should be an intimate act, that once institutionalized, it is degraded. It becomes an instrument of social control, hence the danger of a state religion. But in a secular society such as ours, where religion seems to be itself under sanction, the last true opportunity most of us have for intimacy is the intercourse between two lovers, which all religions sanction. I knew I had the makings of a Sunstone presentation. But I should warn you now that the logic governing this essay is associative, not teleological. I won't know where I'm going until I get there. And I'm still not there, as Betsy will tell you. That word essay, from the old French verb meaning to try or to attempt, and ultimately from the unattested and hence hypothetical vulgar Latin, exagiare, to weigh out, from late Latin exagium, a weighing balance, from Latin exigere, to weigh out or examine, see exact. That word essay bears a surprising relation to the topic of this essay, which is pornography. And incidentally, let me warn you that that's another flaw with this essay. It relies heavily on etymology, so you'll hear more about more words than you thought relevant. And another word of warning is in order. I presented a truncated and abortive version of this essay at the Sunstone Symposium in 1997, so some of this might be familiar to some of you. And the final flaw, this essay proceeds like a sidewinder when you'd think an arrow could do the job. But I am aiming for your heart, so all apparent digressions will converge when you least expect it and pin you to your seats. I hope. And one last metaphor to toss into the mix. When people want to indicate how offensive violence is in the mass media, or has become, they talk of a pornographic level of violence. Isn't that just backwards? Shouldn't we be talking about a violent level of pornography? Isn't brutality far worse than intimacy? Well, enough deconstructionist blather. Pornography traffics in the ordinary. There are few things more common among humans than sexual intercourse. That some men might have trouble defining sexual intercourse might indicate it's less common than they wish it. But the rest of us know it when we see it. Eating and talking are more common social activities. Breathing and excreting are more common private activities. But if the entertainment media are to be believed, it's far more common than, say, voting. So common is it that we recognize simulations of desire, arousal, copulation, and satiation without having ever done or seen the thing itself, though the depictions of these states be patently improbable. I mean, really, have you ever rolled around on a beach in a swimsuit with the surf breaking over you and tried to even imagine being aroused instead of doused? That was a footnote. That's another problem with this paper. Half of it's in the footnotes, and I'm going to find trouble shifting back and forth there. That recognition, that ability to recognize those simulations, makes pornography possible. Stimulation by abstraction, that is, these simulations of sexual arousal may feed back into one's psyche, amplifying the sensations that accompany arousal. Now, my generation called this being turned on, and the analogy with machinery is instructive. It is as if we believed such stimulation were beyond our control. When the switch is thrown, we change states from rest to arousal. Feedback, that busiest of buzzwords in the corporate body, shares this same mechanical quality. It is the amplification of a signal by the machinery that produces the signal, which in turn produces a louder signal, which feeds back through the loop and is amplified and loops until something, a membrane in the speaker or a microphone or an eardrum, ruptures. Pornography works the same way. So even thus qualified, there are few things more common in life than sex. Sex is, to the species, what food is to the individual, its continuation, the guarantor of its survival. We must mate fairly frequently, though not as often as we eat, if mating is controlled by any kind of evolutionary imperative. If not common, sex has to be nearly instinctual to work. At least for mammals and other large creatures. Even for fleas, flowers, and flamingos, for any species which reproduces sexually, it is the focus of much energy in all nature. There are far more seeds than fruits. Asexual reproduction would be more common, but as far as I know, it doesn't occur amongst humans at all. Yet. And among sheep and other mammals, not without our help. But we humans have been manipulating reproduction in our fellow mammals for a long, long time, as Genesis 30 shows. And Jacob took him rods of green poplar and of white and of the hazel and chestnut tree and pilled white streaks in them. He peeled them and made the white appear which was in the rods. And he set the rods which he had pilled before the flocks in the gutters, in the watering troughs when the flocks came to drink, that they should conceive when they came to drink. And the flocks conceived before the rods and brought forth cattle, ring-straked, speckled and spotted. And Jacob did separate the lambs and set the faces of the flocks toward the ring-straked and all the brown in the flock of the Laban. And he put his own flocks by themselves and put them not unto Laban's cattle. It came to pass, whensoever the stronger cattle did conceive, that Jacob laid the rods before the eyes of the cattle in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. And when the cattle were feeble, he put them not in. So the feebler were Laban's, and the stronger Jacob's. And the man increased exceedingly, and had much cattle, and maidservants, we don't know if he did the same trick with them, and manservants, and camels and asses. This process is presented neither as folk magic nor as an experiment on Jacob's part, just a mechanism he employs to fool Laban and earn for himself a larger dowry, one he feels that Laban had screwed him out of by sending Leah into his tent after his first 7 years of service. And what is marriage but an experiment in eugenics, whether parents or children arrange the marriage? I won't answer that question. I'll just ask another, and for Mormons, eternal eugenics at that. A Darwinian would not blame Laban for marrying both his daughters to such a loyal, hard-working, desirable young man. We make mating harder for humans than for sheep. We promote stable pairing and bonding. That is, in fact, a prime function of religion. This goes all the way back to Eden. We invest sex with significance, surround it with symbols of endurance, eternity and power, like this ring. Notice I had to check to make sure I had it on. We shroud it in solemnity, involve it in ritual, and to impress on the young the privilege of mating. But no matter how much Kool-Aid we pour into the pitcher, when we finish mixing it up, we're still serving primarily water. There lingers in the married mind a sense that somehow, on a fundamental level, forbidden sex is better than permitted sex. Pornography plays to that suspicion, at least in men it does, by promising wild sex, unfettered sex. To the person who feels trapped in a marriage, there lingers a nagging impression that somehow, and I would imagine that at least one or two of you women have had this experience, I know it's common among men, a big fuss is being made about something rather trivial, something quite common, a little more rare perhaps than a good back rub, but certainly as common as a ripe peach. And it is. For this reason, the wildest sex around, the most abandoned, the most free, is that sex with the most far-reaching consequence. Kids. That's why it's the function of pornography in our culture to domesticate sex. Let me deal with those two paradoxes one at a time. It may seem perverse to proclaim that the most mundane form of sex is the wildest. But in so doing, I do not have in mind the idea that children represent chains and bondage to the parents. I'm pursuing rather an idea that E.E. Cummings expressed in his groping for a better metaphor for a Savior than the Son of God, expressed in the opening and closing lines of one of his poems. I'm going to read the whole poem, but like all of Cummings' poems, it's going to be hard for you to follow, so pay close attention. Conceive a man, should he have anything, would give a little more than it away. His autumn's winter being summer's spring, who moved by standing in November's May. From whose, if loud, most howish time derange the silent whys of such a deathlessness, remembrance, might no patient mind unstrange learn, nor could all earth's rotting scholars guess that life shall not for living find the rule. And dark beginnings are his luminous ends, who far less lonely than a fire is cool took bedfellows for moons, mountains for friends. Open your thighs to fate, and, if you can, withholding nothing, world, conceive a man. For a control freak, opening his life or hers to fate is a discomfort in the oldest meaning of that word, a defeat, not just a thwarting of plans or purposes. In a world in which every agent is free, has moral autonomy, and deserves respect, which is the world I think I live in, to invite another to share one's life is to surrender. The act risks all, especially for a Mormon who has accepted this discipline of priesthood. The rights of the priesthood are inseparably connected with the powers of heaven, and the powers of heaven cannot be controlled nor handled only upon the principles of righteousness. Incidentally, that's a strange wording in that last phrase, or at least the punctuation is strange, implying that there are other principles necessary. This strangeness reflects in the speaking voice of Joseph Smith the tenuous grasp any man has on the powers of heaven. Man or woman, for the priesthood is extended to, though not conferred on, woman in temple marriage. And for either one, when we undertake to cover our sins, or to gratify our pride, our vain ambition, or to exercise control or dominion or compulsion upon the souls of the children of men, in any degree of unrighteousness, behold, the heavens withdraw themselves. The Spirit of the Lord is grieved. And when it is withdrawn, amen to the priesthood or the authority of that man. Both those quotes are from the 121st section. When two free agents orbiting about such insubstantial loci as vows and passions invite a third into the gravity of the dance, the increase in chance, or to borrow a term from the corporate world, the exposure to risk, goes up exponentially. Especially when, as for a Mormon couple joined in the temple, the rules of the dance are these. No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood. Only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness of unfeigned, by kindness and pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul without hypocrisy and without guile. And with each child invited into the orbit, the complexity of the dance and the energy it both generates and consumes increases exponentially. If you think of this dance as the orbiting of electrons about a hypothetical nucleus, including faith, lust, hope, fear, charm, wrath, and joy amongst its quarks and gluons, you might understand that a kind of uncertainty principle applies to the determination at any one moment of who's where and moving how. Perhaps that metaphor might even give you a sense of what moral agency means and how God could both be omniscient and yet the guarantor of free agency. It might be that he can't know what any one of us might do at any one time. But regardless of that, the fewer particles in orbit, the simpler such a system would be, and the more stable. That's why a couple who want to have children are engaging in an edgier, wilder sex than a couple playing around with the impedimenta of bondage. To draw a distinction Scott Card once made, sex is crude, but not dirty. It shares that distinction with crudités that have been washed. To be really dirty, sex has to be domesticated. And, here's my other paradox, that's where pornography comes in. Like professional sports, pornography takes the player off the field, where he is an active participant, and turns him into a passive observer. Although some little league parents may participate more actively than their children. Pornography turns the athlete into a spectator and milks him. And I do mean money. So, there's no mis... Oh, let me back up because that sounded wrong. So there's no misunderstanding between us. I will define just what I mean by pornography. It doesn't seem right to interrupt a confession with a definition, but then if I did things right, I'd have nothing to confess. According to two of my favorite dictionaries, pornography derives from the Greek pornographos, writing about prostitutes. Constituent elements are porne, harlot or prostitute, and graph. And the word is comes into English about 1840 or 1850, 150 years ago. At root, then, the following lines by John Milton could not be adjudged pornographic, because they describe Eve in a state of grace as created by God and help meet for Adam and his wife. She is a veil down to the slender waist, her unadorned golden tresses wore disheveled, and wanton ringlets waved as the vine curls her tendrils, which implied subjection, but required with gentle sway, and by her yielded, by him best received, yielded with coy submission, modest pride and sweet, reluctant, amorous delay. Nor those mysterious parts were then concealed. Then was not guilty shame, dishonest shame of nature's work, honorable, sin-bred. How have ye troubled all mankind with shows instead, mere shows of seeming pure, and banished from man's life his happiest life, simplicity and spotless innocence. So passed they naked on, nor shunned the sight of God or angel, for they thought no ill. So hand in hand they passed. By those definitions, this passage is not pornographic. Yet a scholar whose name I cannot recall, in a conservative Catholic journal I cannot now identify, asserted that this description is pornographic. Only if the very subject of sex itself were obscene might one make that assertion, though a feminist critic might find the demeanor attributed to Eve pornographic for the opposite reason, that she's too much subject to Adam, too coy. And that's another interesting word in this context. But I digress. Note that both dictionaries use the word harlot in their respective definitions. Whether because it better fits the sense of the Greek than whore, or out of a sense of lexical decorum, I know not. But it introduces another interesting element into the definition. The American Heritage Dictionary defines harlot as a woman of ill repute, especially a whore or prostitute. Comes from the Middle English, harlot or herlot, vagabond, itinerant jester, male servant, prostitute. Notice the switch in genders back there. From the Old French, harlot or arlet or herlot, a young fellow or a vagabond. And in this particular dictionary, that herlot has a little cross by it, which means that it's of obscure origin. Now, many of these senses apply to Bette Midler's backup group, the Harlettes, but I don't think there's anything obscure about the origin of that name, although the jester element persists, surprisingly enough. So as a word of ill repute, harlot began life as a vagabond, coming in Old French from God only knows where, an idler, a young man with wanderlust and no visible means of support, a jester, a male servant, a prostitute. Probably the word came with the young men who carried the disease, but when it stayed on at court, it was applied, especially by the transplanted Norman nobility of England, to women, possibly servant women from the English folk. That harlot is of obscure origin may indicate a language family other than Indo-European. The stranger was not just restless, but restless in a strange land. This harlot brought a new presence into the culture that it needed a new word in Norman English. The old word was whore. It, too, is a word with a history, like all these words. From before 1100, the word which is cognate, the word is whore, H-O-R-E, which is cognate with the Greek or the German hur, and the Old Norse hora, akin to the Gothic horse or harlot, and to the Latin carus, or deer. By the magic of Grimm's law, that word in Latin, carus, had trickled down in German and other Germanic languages to horse. But it's clear that what's at root in both words is some sense of what should be cherished. It isn't. Prostitute, incidentally, which I glossed past, and I have to do this, is from the past participle of prostituere, to expose publicly. From pro, forth, in public and statuary to set or place, which is from stare, the past participle of status, to stand. In other words, prostitute is a word which comes from a public assertion, a putting forth of oneself in a way that is apparently deemed immodest. So this word, whore, at its Indo-European root, meaning to like or to desire, tripped off the Germanic tongue as whore, but rolled off the Latin lingua as caress, charity, cherish. Here we find the same ambivalence as at the root of the Greek porne, which derives from root, meaning to traffic in or sell. And that from the idea of to hand over or distribute.
To explain this principle is not surprising. What is surprising is how he turns the usual formulation on its head. By the standard of this teaching, it is wrong to speak of carnal desires, of urges of the flesh. Jesus, in the logic of his metaphor, teaches that appetites have little to do with physiological sensations or needs or the, quote, urgencies so common in bad fiction. As the body, as portrayed by our Lord, purges itself, repairs itself, hosts and houses the spirit. It is the spirit, the will, that needs discipline. Pornography appeals to the spirit, to that same spirit which doth possess your bodies at the time you go out of this life, that same spirit which will have power to possess your body in the eternal world. In speaking those words, Amulek asserts the difficulty of repentance at the last crisis because the sinful element is the spirit, not the flesh. To sell sex, the vendor has to disguise the ordinariness of what is offered. Remember Tamar's veil? When Judah saw her, he thought her an harlot because she had covered her face. This might be a clue to help me understand why, in most pictures of naked women taken for men, the women are not naked. There is almost always some wisp of clothing clinging to flesh, some lichen for the immortal hydrocarbons, which incidentally is a quote from a poet. It is not the nudity that is offered in pornography, but the availability. Nudity is not in and of itself pornographic. In the iconography of Western art, nudity is often associated with innocence, as it was in that quote from Milton. In the iconography of porn, it is associated with eagerness. She is taking off her clothes just for you. This may be why Justice Potter Stewart said that he couldn't define pornography, but he knew it when he saw it, It is the solicitation that he recognized, not the skin. Alex Comfort, and comfort, interestingly enough, is an old term for lovemaking, one that survives in the euphemism comfort women, used by the Japanese to refer to women they had forced into prostitution in countries they overran during World War II. And I don't know why the Japanese chose that word to translate whatever they were calling it in Japanese, but it is a fact that any time you read about this in Japanese government dispatches or anywhere else, they're called comfort women. Alex Comfort strikes just the right note in The Joyous Sex, A Gourmet Guide to Lovemaking, with his extended analogy between sex and eating. As it is possible to eat and enjoy food without rituals of self-abasement, so it is possible to share intimacy in lovemaking. But pornography will have none of that. Seth Warshawski, one of the hottest entrepreneurs in the e-commerce, has made a fortune on Mac porn. The meat is always uniform, always served in a clean, well-lighted place, and always well done. But it's always out of reach. He's selling the sizzle without the steak. And now, in a truly fitting fashion, he's opening a stock trading site with sex as the teaser, I assume in place of a ticker. About the only thing more illusory than intimacy by pornography is wealth by stock profits. Bull market indeed. There is no there. If you lust after a picture of a woman, do you commit a picture of adultery with her in your heart? If all your retirement funds are invested in the stock market, as mine are, do you really have a future? Well, yes, you have a future as long as you're alive. And if you believe in Mormon, you have a future for a long time after that. It just may not be the one you thought you were planning. As with food, a cult of the exotic surrounds sex. Just as haute cuisine glamorizes eating, so haute couture glamorizes sex. And nowhere more clearly than the advertising for those obscenely overpriced rags. But it's not just in the veil that glamour disguises the ordinariness of sex. Other desperate disguises creep in, eager to hide the ordinariness of sex. Cruelty, as in sadism. Self-hatred, as in masochism. Politics, as in domination, submission, and contempt, as in depersonalization. And in this connection, glamour is an interesting word indeed. Its earliest meaning, now archaic, is magic. Enchantment, a magic spell. It's a Scottish variant of the word grammar, because learning was associated with magic. Now, that's the first time in many years that I've thought my training as an English major had any glamour to it at all. And I ask you, what could be more inimical to pornography than the drone of the scholar dissecting it in the dry language of affect and intent? I should probably read you the section titles here, but I'm afraid I'd give more offense with them than not. Pornography, although this one is called Giving the Bird, as you'll find out why. Pornography, though always available as a kind of literary junk food, has long since nosed its way into haute couture, as into popular culture, as chic frisson. I hope my French isn't so bad you can't understand it. In this, it constitutes a full-scale assault on intimacy, a marketing of the most spiritual of appetites, an invasion of wonder by advertising. For there is a sense of wonder in any intimacy between lovers, but in pornography, as in advertising, sex becomes the realm and activity of the young. Sex between your parents or old geezers is always shown as funny, not comic, just laughable. And between the young is dramatic, if not tragic. But that same Shakespeare who gave us in Romeo and Juliet the tragedy of youthful passion also gave us in Antony and Cleopatra the tragedy of middle-aged passion. An honest treatment of mature themes, which pornography could never handle. In pornography, the old black magic is a thing that they do so well, the sexual athletes. But making love could never be as boring as porn makes it appear. At least it hasn't been for me. Pornographic movies turn sex into an endurance event. Just another athletic competition you aren't cut out for. just as you couldn't play in the same league with Michael Jordan. But I don't think that's the reason for the undisguised contempt on the faces of the porn stars. And I guess I'd have to confess, if it's not already clear, that I've seen some of these movies, which is why I know they're undisguised contempt on the faces of the porn stars, when they're not trying to pretend that they're being stimulated and aroused. They are contemptuous of you for a different reason. To dig out that reason, I want to return to Desmond Morris and his discussion of hand gestures. The reason he reasons that they are a vestigial simian dominance display, a heritage of our primate past, and I quote, "The explanation is that sexual actions are employed as threatening devices in a large number of species, including our nearest relatives, the monkeys and apes. A male monkey will often mount a subordinate as a method of demonstrating his dominance. Once mounted, he makes a few pelvic thrusts and then dismounts again. There is no mating contact, he merely goes through the motions. When a human male makes an obscene gesture, he is carrying out a special version of the same act." Well, that doesn't really explain anything, but just push the answer back to a different species. You remember Morris's question is, why, if sex isn't dirty, why is it used so much for gestures and words that are obscene and contemptuous? I wouldn't bother to discuss it if there were not a female obscene sign, the fig. That is the counterpart of the middle finger jerk. That's Morris's term for the gesture, and not the one who makes it. Classifying it as a copulation gesture, Morris describes it thus. Copulation gestures are of two kinds, those that emphasize insertion and those that represent pelvic thrusting. I didn't mention this, but this is a book about gestures, sociological study, so-called. Phallic insertion is the key to the age-old fig sign, in which the male thumb is squeezed between the female fingers. This is done with a closed hand, the thumb protruding from between the first and second fingers, like a penis inserted through labia. This gesture, popular in ancient Rome and surviving on early amulets, is now almost worldwide in distribution in the form of a lucky charm. Small carved hands showing the fig posture are sold in curio shops from London to Rio. And as in so many other cases, the wearers are probably ignorant of its true meaning. Its protective role may seem odd. Why should an obscene copulatory gesture, have come to stand for good luck? The answer appears to be that it is a distraction display. For many Mediterranean peoples, there is a strong belief in the power of the evil eye, which if it looked you in the face, would bring you misfortune. It was not always certain who was possessed by the evil eye, so it was wise to wear some protective device. A gesture as shocking as the fig sign was sure to attract the evil eye's attention, and thereby save the amulet's wearer from the direct stare. Well, Linda Lee James and James Charlton echo Morris, and in fact he's one of their sources, in discussing this sign, adding to his speculation the information presented without further discussion that it is called the fica, or fig, because the inserted thumb is about the size and shape of the fig, which, being an ancient symbol of abundance, carried with it a sense of virility and fecundity, partly because there's so many seeds in a fig. But there may be something else at work here. I think there is. Miranda and Bruce Mitford, discussing the symbolism of food, says of the fig, "The fruit of the fig tree, with its many seeds, represents the feminine realm, fertility and prosperity. A basket of figs symbolizes woman as goddess or mother. The fruit has erotic symbolism and was sacred to Bacchus, god of wine and vegetation. Adam and Eve covered their nakedness with leaves from the fig tree." Now, there's an evil association. In this case, its use as a lucky charm might have nothing to do with distracting an evil eye. It may be a remnant of a religion, now all but gone, that honored and worshipped the goddess. I think it more likely that the fig sign represents a sexually aroused female, just as the extended middle finger, or bird, represents a sexually aroused male. Both Morris's and Leon Charlton's explanations have that faint sense of eureka that accompanies the overly labored folk etymology, like that old story about posh deriving from an acronym for port outbound, starboard home. when in fact it derives from a Roma phrase or gypsy phrase, those of you who don't recognize the Roma. That's what we'd call a gypsy word when I was younger. This elegant explanation of mine would be clearer if the gesture were made, at least in one culture, with the thumb between the two middle fingers. But from what I read, it's not. So my elegant explanation has to be as much a speculation as anything Desmond Morris has come up with. But suppose I'm right. It's not too hard to see how such a symbol might be made into an amulet, a lucky charm. No need to twist things around a convoluted idea like some imaginary evil eye, which B. Wayne Jorgensen on an earlier draft of this paper points out that the biblical evil eye has to do with scorning the needy. Those same harlots that wandered out of nowhere into Indo-European space sometime after the fall of Rome. Seems a little strange to me that Morris has to reach so far for the explanation. No need to twist things around a convoluted idea like some imaginary evil eye and posit a distraction display to deflect it, since the evil eye would be smarter than to fall for that anyway. Moreover, Morris reports that this gesture is used playfully as an invitation to mating as well as being used aggressively. If it were indeed emblematic of an aroused female, its use need not imply dominance in any way. Indeed, it could invoke the goddess and celebrate her fertility. But if that idea has any merit, why would an emblem of worship, an invocation of the goddess, be used as a contemptuous gesture? The widespread use of both gestures, although the fig isn't that common in the United States, the widespread use of both gestures as gestures of contempt might result from the clash between matriarchal and patriarchal religions and cultures we see played out in the historical books of the Old Testament. And this is pure speculation. The mountaintop worship so offensive to the prophets of Israel appears to have been a fertility religion centered on worship of female sexuality, or worship via female sexuality. Use of emblems of sexual activity as gestures of contempt could have arisen as a conscious attack on that kind of worship. Such gestures would be one with the contempt for the viewer exhibited in pornography because they represent a direct assault on two kinds of intimacy, sexual and religious. If Mormonism were a fertility religion, and it could be argued that with its practice of polygyny, its recognition of a mother in heaven, and its teaching of eternal increase, it is. It would seem to have embodied that clash of religions in its own history. That these spiteful gestures could be derogatory of fertility doesn't surprise me. But it did when I first thought of it back there in that car speeding along the spine of the Snake River, or the bluffs above it. It seems to share an element of discomfort with other open displays of fertility, rather like people's discomfort with breastfeeding in public places. That discomfort with fertility, children, reproduction, is exactly what pornography represents. It is propagated as a way to diminish and derogate a simple and simply satisfied appetite. Perhaps the difference between pornography and pictures of naked people, for each person who beholds them, has to do with some sense of worship that goes back to that clash between the patriarchal and matriarchal cultures. And I would submit that it's easier to transmit a culturally derived clash like that than it is to transmit something genetic from our simian ancestors. Because we are, after all, a species that uses and manipulates symbols, including words. To what you might call a solution. He begins, pornography is like a squalid, unnecessary little country which owes its independence to a vagary of history. But though pornography is seldom of much importance, it may be of considerable interest. For to talk about it is to talk about the great powers adjacent to it. Pornography speaks the language of art. In recent centuries, it has come within the sphere of an influence of law. Psychology and morals have vested interests in it. Moreover, occasionally pornography becomes genuinely important when it is used as a seat of operations by the erotic nihilists like Seth Warshawski, who would like to destroy every sort of social and moral law and devote their energies to subverting society as such. He then describes an ambivalence toward the subject, summarizing it thus: a liberal suspicion of censorship and a conservative dislike of pornography are not very compatible. Some sort of compromise is necessary if they are to live together. Their marriage, being of the earthly sort, will never be without tension, but maybe the quarrel between them can be patched up well enough for practical purposes. And the practical compromise he comes to is this: in the matter of the sale and display of pornography, the state, the apparatus of the law, should have two effective policies. It should strictly forbid making pornography accessible to the young, i.e. no one under 18 admitted. But as for pornography for adults, the law should rest content with a decent hypocrisy. Keep it out of the marketplace, sell it under the counter, and the law won't bother you. The main function of laws against adult pornography is to express disapproval of it. Despite his strong feelings about pornography, Eliot feels equally strongly that almost anything done to fight pornography only advertises it and arouses interest in it. To me, the biggest danger of pornography is that it turns the participant into an observer. It cuts so deeply against the grain of intimacy that it destroys the foundation of what should be a stable marriage. Enough of it, and we will come to reject any kind of intimacy because it requires too much effort. And we're almost at the end. Despite the song title, I don't think you can be addicted to love. The addiction, if there is one, is to romance, to wanting to believe what I am not. Romance always focuses on one's own feelings. Love focuses on the feelings of the loved one. Love is always directed outward. Romance is interior. Love is so widely available that no perverse glamour attaches to it. Let me be clear about that. For you, love is an opportunity to meet another person's need. It is available in unlimited supply. You can lose yourself in it. That is why God is love. The only effective way of finding your own feelings is to lose your life in service to others. When you do that, pornography will not interest you because it is concerned solely with your own feelings, and you are concerned with the feelings of others. I hope someday to know that myself in a more than hypothetical way. Thank you.